Hello and welcome to another episode of In Her Corner. My name is Lisely Sitali, and this is a podcast dedicated to celebrating and empowering women working at every level of sport, on and off the field. Today I'm really excited for our guest, as her name is Maggie Murphy, and she has a job that I think many of us football fans would love. She's the general manager of Lewis FC, the world's only club to distribute revenue equally between both its male and female teams. Welcome, Maggie.
Thank you so much for having me on here, Lisely. You've got an incredible cast of other women. So, I feel very honored to be there.
Yeah. Well, you are definitely one of those many wonderful women. So thank you for taking the time to speak to us, especially at a time in the season where it's really busy for you at the club. So obviously, Maggie, I'm a huge admirer of you and the work that you do at Lewis FC. But for the benefit of our listeners who maybe haven't got across you before and the work you're doing at Lewis, do you just care to give us a little bit of a brief of a summary about you and how you got into this role?
Sure. So I'm the general manager at Lewis FC, which is a small club close to Brighton on the south coast. Our men are a very traditional non-league football team. So, you know, most towns around the country will have a club like Lewis. But the women's team are in the championship. So we are an elite football team on the women's side. And I've been in this role since last summer. So I'm almost, so we're speaking in July, and it was July that I arrived back at the club. And before then, I actually spent 10, 15 years not working in football, but actually working in anti-corruption and human rights work. So I am a little bit different as a general manager. I haven't come up through the footballing ranks. I've really been working on international work, advocacy and campaigning, on different policy issues, but all around social purpose, all around trying to, I don't know, it seems a bit of a cliche, but, you know, trying to make the world a better place. But Lewis FC is the kind of place that allows me to try to do that, but through the medium of football, because of its incredible stance it takes on all kinds of social justice issues.
Yeah, now that's a great summary of your background and obviously how you came to Lewis FC and why Lewis FC rather than any other football club. So do you just want to talk to us a little bit about how you got the role as a general manager at Lewis? Because you mentioned there that your path was sort of not the conventional one. And I think that it would be interesting for people to get a little insight into because you've got this really great, strong background in humanitarian advocacy work. So how do you make that transition from there to football?
Yeah, so it is a little, I don't know whether my path is necessarily one that is a typecast one that people can necessarily follow, because I myself went through a lot of learning and a lot of thinking and reflecting around my own career and what I wanted to do in the world. So it is quite personal and quite unique to me, I guess. I've always played football. I've always tried to play football. When I grew up, I was growing up on the Isle of Wight as a child, and, you know, I just loved the game. You know, I wanted to get stuck in. I wanted to, break free of some of the restraints that girls' sports like netball were placed on me. So I've always been trying to play, and you know, even when I left school and before I went to university, I travelled overseas, and I was in Tanzania for almost a year, and found a team there. So football's always been there, but it never became my focus. I never wanted to play professionally. It was always something on the side, something powerful that I did and was a part of my identity, but it was on the side. I had this career goal, and I was working towards this international work. But I think for me, I spent 2 or 3 years living in different parts of Africa, for example. I also spent a bit of time out in the French West Indies and also in the Netherlands and in Germany working on these social justice issues. But I think that football was very, very personal to me. And I guess a few years ago, especially around the time of the FIFA corruption scandal, I was working in corruption at the time, anti-corruption. I was spending a lot of time looking at illicit financial flows and shell companies and how money is transferred around the world to enable people to do corrupt things. And then suddenly this corruption scandal hits the news, and it was like a light bulb moment in many ways for me. I kind of knew it was happening, but for me it was an amalgamation of lots of parts of my life. There was this corruption side, there was an abuse of power, there was a huge gender dynamic, because obviously at the time Sepp Blatter, who was the FIFA president, he he was, you know, the person that's well known for saying, you know, maybe if women wore shorter shorts and tighter tops, then more people would be interested in women's football. And he was in charge of growing the game internationally. You know, that was the person that was overall in charge of making football for all, I guess. And so these kind of different, this clash of all these different elements, it made me suddenly realize, oh, hang on a sec, that's why it was such a struggle for me to play football. That's why we always had the worst pitches and no funding and like begging for scraps of money for this or that, always having the worst kit, the worst resources, not being banned from tournaments, being stopped from being played. You know, all these barriers were there because the people who were in charge, whether it was at FIFA, whether it was, you know, at my local football association, just did not care about women's football. For them, football was something else. It wasn't actually about enabling everyone to play.
Yeah.
So I guess that was, that's a bit of a roundabout way of saying that I became a little bit more of an activist later on in life. You know, once I'd hit my 30s, I was like, hang on a sec, why was this all so difficult? And that's when I started to become a lot more involved in trying to open up access to opportunity, equality and respect for women and girls in football.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually a really good story that you say it's quite personal to you. But I think at this moment in time in the world when people are becoming much more awakened and much more, you know, conscious of how they can help, you know, stop suffering and injustice, I actually think it's a really good, relevant story to tell that, you know, you had this passion for this game and you'd suffered all these obstacles trying to play it, seeing all the challenges in different parts of the world and kind of seeing a running theme, right? That there was this, the inequity of the experience of women playing football in the world was the same. And it came from the fact that those people who had the power to enable that participation in the game, as you said, rightfully, unfortunately, the face of it at that point was just Sepp Blatter, which trickled down to every element of FIFA, as well as other footballing entities, just didn't give it that level of respect and time that men's football has got in order to grow it to this big lucrative brand it's become. So I actually think, you know, there'll probably be people listening there who a lot of those elements will resonate with them. And I think you finding a strength to say, well, I have all this background, I have all this good ability to understand how to advocate for people and properly campaign to get them better share of the table, you know, I think is actually a really pertinent one, particularly now when people are looking for ways to be their own activists in order to see changes that they have felt so helpless to be able to affect.
And ultimately, we're talking about a game. We're talking about a sport, you know, and the beauty of football is that all you need is a ball, right? And, you know, jumpers for goalposts and all that. And yet, even though it is just a game, it's not law, it's not politics, it's just a game, we still are restricting girls' opportunity to play, to exercise, for teamwork, for confidence building, for all these things. It's just a game. Why is it so difficult for us to just level it up and allow girls to be the best they possibly can be? And that's a really interesting element, because it is a game, because it is leisure, because it is just a sport. It's even more significant in a way, because it's about blocking a woman or a girl's right to be their full self. You know, to exercise, to have fun. You know, we stop women and girls from having fun.
Yeah.
That is why actually I think that I've come around to thinking this. I don't think I ever thought this before, you know, in my 20s or my teens, but actually football is really important because it is just a game. And if we're blocking women and girls from taking part, we're saying that they are not worthy to be their full selves. They're not worthy of having fun and leisure time. And I think that for me was a bit of a, I don't know, just something that suddenly I realized that it all hinged on that. Like, why are we stopping girls from being their full selves?
Yeah, no, I think in a lot of ways it acts almost as a microcosm for society in general, right? There are a lot of barriers still that even, you know, us, you and me living here in the UK in a very, you know, what people would consider developed progressive society, that football is actually sadly an epitome of the gender gap, you know, in a lot of ways. So, and when you are looking at it like that, and you were looking on the outside in, when you came into Lewis FC, was there a particular challenge you saw straight off the bat that you thought, this is something we can fix in order to try and help remove those barriers that you talked really well about there, to try and even up that experience of both the men and the women's side?
Yeah, I mean, I think right from the off, I mean, Lewis FC, like you mentioned in the introduction, I didn't mean to kind of end up in football. And, you know, Lewis is trying to normalize the idea that men and women are, you know, worthy of equal respect and value. So we have equal playing budgets between the men's side and the women's side. We are currently seen to be inspirational and outstanding and forward thinking and future focused. And I'm like, yeah, but we're just doing the minimum, you know? This is like, just treat your men and women the same, treat your boys and girls the same. I do hope that one day the fact that we have been a vanguard club is laughed at. You know, this idea that what we're doing is so phenomenally different and inspirational, you know, I do hope that that is kind of a marker in the sand in 40, 50 years time, going, oh God, do you remember when like no clubs did this apart from that one little club down in south of England? So I think even just from the start, the fact that Lewis didn't just talk a good game when it came to equality and inclusion and diversity and respect and, you know, supporting gender equality, but actually took that step to, and it hurts. It's not easy. It's not been an easy thing for the club to do, but they did it. And I think it was just that element of putting your money where your mouth is. So for me as an individual, they took the decision, the club took the decision to split revenue equally back in 2017. At the time, I saw the club take that stance, and I just saw it on Twitter, and it, you know, this club had just chosen to do it. And and you could become an owner of this club as well. It is 100% fan owned. And immediately I just clicked and became an owner, because I didn't think that I would ever even come to a game. I didn't even think I'd ever come down to Lewis. I mean, it's funny now when you roll forward a couple of years, but I just wanted them to know that I had seen it. And I'd seen them and I backed it, whether I came down to a game or not. I just wanted them to know that it had my backing. And so I became an owner a couple of years ago. And funnily enough, you know, a couple of years later, I'm sat in the office running the show.
I love that story about how you saw the actions that Lewis took on Twitter, and the power of how much that moved you, and what the consequences of being able to respond to what seems like a sort of menial action at the time, but the consequences then had for putting you in the role that you're in now. And when you consider where Lewis are in terms of finances as a club, for them to make that sacrifice is a lot bigger, right, than other, you know, really lucrative teams like your likes of Barcelona, Manchester City, who also all have female sides to their clubs, but they don't obviously split the revenue equally like you guys do. So now when you're looking at a club like Real Madrid, who've just announced that they're going to have a women's side for the first time ever, is there an opportunity for you to go to them as sort of, you know, a leader in your industry in football and say to them, could they mirror your model so that, you know, as you're saying, it then becomes the new norm, right? If big teams like Real start to invest in their female football club the way you are, and they've set it up from the off the bat, that could then become the new norm as more big teams come into that way of thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get too worried, I guess, about the big clubs and what they choose to do, because they, you know, the big clubs will always have a portion of money to create a really great environment for female players. I get a lot of pushback, and I get a lot of kind of people telling me that, well, it's all right for you to say because you're a poor club. And I'm like, yeah, exactly right. We don't have loads of money sloshing around, but we've taken this decision. And then, you know, you might have even smaller clubs than us going, well, it's okay for you because you're a big club, so you've got more money. And you're like, oh, okay, so now we're a big club. All right. So there's always a reason for not introducing equality. The one thing that I would love to see maybe from the big clubs is, if not equal treatment and equal investment or equal playing budgets now, how about starting with their academy teams? And I'm talking like literally their under eights. Imagine if they invest equally right now into the under eights setup, which means that in 10 or 15 years time, you would have players coming through that have always had equal treatment. That suddenly becomes more palatable maybe for some bigger clubs, the idea that, okay, well, we'll just start with the under eights team and then next year it'll be the under nines team and they get
So that's what they mean to go on is really your argument there, to say start with your youth setup, see what that affects, and then maybe that can then become sort of the blueprint for how they then operate the club from, you know, junior right the way to professional elite.
Yeah, and it's the same thing with, I think most people think that salaries are way overblown in the Premier League. That's not really what people are after in the women's game, but they are after top quality facilities and excellent coaching staff and, you know, medical facilities and all the rest of it. So people get hung up on this idea of our equal pay and say, well, that's just not possible. And I'm like, there's lots of different ways of showing that you value and respect your women's team. And that you are future focused. I mean, sometimes when I've seen a couple of these clubs that are ditching their women's sides right now during COVID time, I'm like, what are you guys doing? Where do you think we're going to be in 10 years time, 15 years time, 20 years time? Do you really think that women's football is going to plateau right here? No way. This is the place where you invest. This is like, we're on the way up. Like, female participation rates are going through the roof. They're increasing whilst men's participation rates have plateaued or are decreasing. So where do you think the future is? Like, yeah, you might as well be part of it now.
The game. Yeah, it's exactly. It's a very short-term view and not growing the game. And there's been, you know, quite a lot of stories, particularly around a big football club like Liverpool, you know. Mm-hmm. On one hand, they finally managed to win the Premier League after 30 years, but then, and when you contrast that to how they're treating their women's side, it doesn't, it's back to that inequality that you're talking about, right? Why is it that they can't use the sort of boon moment that they've got in their club where their men's team has succeeded to then use some of that to then ensure that next season their women's team aren't relegated again and can come back up to competing at the highest level? It's just, I guess, it's a new way of thinking, and it's difficult, I guess, to get that because the decision makers in all football clubs aren't headed up by women like you. Right, I feel like that's probably another factor that comes into play.
You definitely need buy-in. At a minimum, you need somebody who represents the women's side of the club at board level. You need someone who's interested and genuinely wants them to succeed. That's like your minimum step, I think, for clubs. But then I think sooner or later, that's almost like a quota. You kind of want to get rid of that quota. You don't really want there to be just like one person that's interested in women's football on a board. You want everyone to be interested in women's football. So I feel that the first step is to get voice and the ability to make decisions at the highest level. But then eventually you want other people to care. And I think it's that's a tricky thing, getting people to care. One of the reasons for that is just simply we don't see much of women's football. Sure, we can all kind of celebrate and acknowledge the fact that we see more women's football today than ever before, but it is still tiny and you still have to search for it. You don't come across it by accident. So we don't accidentally make fans. It's kind of a little bit closed. You have to download the FA player. So you have to know that the women's football games are on there, and you have to go and search for it. It would be incredible if we could be in a situation where people accidentally come across more women's football. And I think we missed a trick with the COVID pandemic. I think that, you know, now is a time to get as much women's football on TV while we have audiences that are a little bit more captured than normal.
Yeah, no, I think that point is a very good one about creating audiences and giving them an opportunity to see the game more visibly. It's certainly something that, you know, in my role, you know, I work for a sports broadcaster. I heavily campaign for. I think probably a lot of my leadership team are like, change the record, love. But, you know, and I won't change the record because I am genuinely a huge believer in the fact that I came into sport and I got excited by sport because I couldn't escape men's football. I couldn't escape male sport. You know, from a young age, you know, I came from Zambia, but, you know, they would show the 3 o'clock games that, you know, are ring fenced here in this country in Zambia. We would see them. Yeah. And so it's just to say that's not an accident that I became passionate about, you know, the English Premier League. It's because in Zambia on ZNBC, which is our BBC equivalent, that game was available. I could see Manchester United playing. I could see Liverpool. I could see Arsenal. And it goes the same. I'm sure you saw that when you were traveling around and working in African countries. There's strong, huge bedrocks there for European football clubs. And the reason of that is the distribution deals of those soccer leagues, right? They are really shown in a really big way there. And so you can't, you know, move away from it. And I think a really good example of that as well is just the focus that is put on celebrating the stories and the individuals of the sport is such a powerful thing that I personally feel like it would be great to see football clubs, particularly like yours, come and pitch the ideas of creating original content with broadcasters, with different media outlets, especially lifestyle media outlets. I think leaning on sports broadcasters, probably we've let you guys down for so long that probably you do need to give us a little bit of a kick up the arse and go and, you know, do deals with the likes of Netflix and Amazon, you know, guys who are playing in a really interesting space and tell the stories about what you're doing as a club, because I think it would resonate with so many people. And maybe that's a good way in. I don't know. I mean, you can tell me because you have a little bit more expertise in that background. But I've always felt really passionately like if we could put more voice and emphasis on the women's clubs and the teams and the stories and the individuals in particular, that could be a really good way into making women's football more prevalent.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that one of the challenges is the lack of diversity in the rooms where decisions are made about what to sponsor and what to put on TV. So some of those rooms that are not very diverse can understand the idea of the World Cup and England playing France or England playing Germany in a World Cup. So they're like, oh, yeah, okay, I get it. I think that they struggle a little bit more with the idea of broader stories or day-to-day women's football. You know, they couldn't, despite the fact that, you know, we played Arsenal a couple of, in fact, our last game before COVID hit was against Arsenal in the FA, in the FA Cup. I don't think those rooms understand the concept of Lewis because they don't know of it in a men's football sense. So that's not an attractive offer, let's say. You know, Reading is in the WSL. Would they get as much airtime as the Chelsea or Man City games? You know, it's different because currently we still think that football is by default male. And so women's football has to adhere to those male structures. We have to look like men's football in order for us to be given respect and to be deemed legitimate, let's say. And I think the World Cup last year and the fact that it was on free-to-view TV and the fact that all the games were on, not just the England games, that was really important for legitimacy and it was really important for generating stories because people found themselves watching, you know, Cameroon versus Argentina and being part of that story so that they understood that when Cameroon played England, they knew a bit of the backstory from the other games. And, you know, those things are really important, but I still think we need a little bit of disrupting in those rooms that decide what is sponsored and what goes on TV.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that because I think that at the moment, as you say, there's a bit of a groupthink that leans towards let's mirror what we're doing for men's football and hope it'll work for publicizing women's game. And that's not the case because, you know, I always say to people in my world to take that approach is much like taking the approach of saying, let's treat the La Liga, let's market it the same way as we do Premier League. Of course, they wouldn't do that. So my question to them is, why would you then do that? For, you know, you have to treat women's football almost as if it's another sport property, right? You have to say there's a particular way in which we celebrate and we market NBA, but and we're going to just treat the WSL that way, right? For as an example, and say we're going to treat it as an entity, as something we should celebrate and package and really get people to get excited about, you know, watching and learning about in the same way as we have the other leagues. Otherwise, I think we're going to kind of stay at this impasse, right? Where it's going to be a few clubs like you guys making great strides, but not being supported to get the eyeballs and to knowledge on what you're doing.
Yeah, and I think that one of our biggest challenges as a women's football club in the second tier, but without the backing of a big men's club, is that we are being pushed to act like a Premier League club on a daily basis, which naturally is a very difficult challenge for us and more attainable for maybe the Chelsea and Man Cities amongst us. So it does feel a lot, it feels like some of our challenges right now, struggles in women's football, is that because of this need to look and feel legitimate, it means that we're meant to look glossy. And I feel like we have so many checkboxes of things that we need to have in our ground. And I'm talking about things like the number of electricity sockets next to media desks in the ground. And I'm like, okay, I'll spend some money to get some more electricity sockets put in. But what about the fact that I've got a community that adores its football club, that comes out in equal numbers to watch their men's team and the women's team? The fact that I've got a whole raft of more than 100 girls that aspire to be on that pitch and who come along to our games and our mascots and, you know, are asking, you know, when do I get to be on that pitch? I want to be like them. Like, when do I get graded on that stuff? Because Lewis is doing incredible stuff in the community, and it's doing an incredible job in rallying the crowds. And we've got some of the best attendances in the country. You know, I don't get graded on that, or it feels like I don't get graded on that. It feels like I get graded on, the number of plug sockets next to my media desks, or like the number of lumens in my floodlights. Even though I've only had the floodlights on for 20 minutes this whole season, you know, and that replacing the floodlights costs us $70,000. You know, it's like
it's about what it's about changing the emphasis on what's important. As you say, the things that are important are the fans, the community that the club serves, right? Because ultimately they are what keep every football club everywhere in the world going. And the fact you have such an engaged fan base that you're actually converting those into players is something that not everyone can tell as a story and show the data to map to that. I think that's a shame that there isn't that, you know, emphasis, as you say, that those things aren't celebrated. Those things aren't the things that you're getting, you know, A stars for, but you should be, because that is actually ultimately what keeps a club going for as long as it does.
And don't get me wrong, like, obviously it's important that women's football is as professional as possible. It's just that I think we are sometimes using the wrong metrics, and I'd like other metrics to be used, because I don't think we need to do things the same way as men's football. You know, we can do things differently. We can focus on different elements, and our broadcast deals don't have to be the same, you know. I understand that we need to be professional. I obviously want my ground to be spick and span and as perfect as possible, but until we have 20 journalists or 10 TV cameras coming into my ground to screen the games, I kind of want to focus my attention on other areas sometimes, you know.
I think that's a perfectly valid, given exactly, you know, where you are and your resources versus, you know, those clubs that are able to afford that money to make, you know, those sort of broadcast sort of glossy standard that you're looking at. And just whilst we're sort of looking ahead to the new season, with you obviously preparing to restart because your league had to be stopped, what is sort of the biggest challenge for you at this moment in time that you feel like you would like to get some help with, or you feel like you could overcome with more support for the women's game?
So a few things, and not in any particular order. Obviously COVID is going to be a massive challenge for us, and that's largely down to the uncertainty. So we are spending a lot of money right now trying to make sure that our ground is as safe as possible for our players coming back. But you know, any full start, any new lockdown, that's going to have a big impact on us financially if play has to stop, you know, for another couple of months or something. Financially, it's going to be very difficult for us to pay salaries and the rest of it. So I think that's just something that every club is facing, and I don't think that it's unique to us. I think that something that we've at Lewis have campaigned on, which would be helpful, would be if we had equal FA Cup prize money. Because at the moment, the disparity between the men's prize fund and the women's prize fund is so much that it's laughable. You know, when we won our game in the FA Cup fourth round to go on to play Arsenal, we won £2,000. But if we were men, we would have won £180,000. That £180,000 has me providing a super safe environment with all the COVID protocols, and also probably extra physios and doctors. And it allows me to give all my players a pay rise. You know, it's just that single game, if we had the same amount of money as men's team gets, it's just transformational. So those are structural difficulties that women's football faces that I don't think are impossible to change, and I need more people to join our call in trying to ask for the rationalization and try to understand why investments can't be made into women's sport that way. And then maybe a slightly more philosophical thing. One of my challenges, and we can investigate this, Lizelle, or we can move on. I don't know. I don't even know about raising it, but I feel like we're often being made to feel grateful for any little bit of progress. So we're made to feel grateful that there's more women's football on TV, or at the moment, you know, we're made to feel grateful that the Premier League have given us just over £1 million to help with our COVID preparations for our testing. I'm so happy to acknowledge the progress that's being made, and I'm happy to acknowledge and thank the Premier League for that small amount of money. But I don't want to be made to feel grateful. And I feel like sometimes the narrative that comes out a little bit, whether it's online or through other mechanisms, is kind of like, yeah, but, you know, at least it's changing a little bit. You know, be grateful for what you have. You know, I remember when 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago, you know, women's football wasn't anywhere. And I'm like, yeah, I know. And that was bad too. I feel like we don't have that much time. We need to crack on and make some of these changes, because I'm kind of tired. I'm 36 years old, but I remember 20 years ago making these same arguments, playing for my own club, about whether we could or could not play in a tournament because, I don't know, it's difficult for me to express, but I feel like a lot of female footballers understand this feeling that we're being made to feel grateful a lot of the time.
Yeah, no, I think it's actually a very good point, and I think it actually goes through the whole fight for women's place in society in general. There is that narrative to say, oh, look at how much progress has been made. But I think at the heart of the issue that is not dealt with is why the issue exists in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. So at the moment in time, women's football has a begging bowl that is put into as and when the more powerful, lucrative side of the game decides to give to it. But nobody is asking the question to say, why do you have a begging bowl in the first place? So I want to just go back there and ask a really kind of, you know, very question, and you cannot answer this if you want, because I realize I'm now straying into an area that might make a lot of people like, feel uncomfortable. But I want to ask it to say, what is the rationale that currently women's side are given by someone like the FA, who obviously holds the rights to the WSL, for not paying you the same amount of money as the men's side of the game? So what is that reason? What is the official reason given to you? Just because I personally don't understand it, and I imagine there's a lot of other people who will be listening to this right now and say, well, why couldn't you get that £180,000? Mm. What was actually the rationale for that, and how do we change that? You know, how do we collectively help to change that?
Yeah, often there's a decline to comment, or a kind of reminder that the FA puts in a lot of money at the moment into the WSL, because the FA runs the WSL and the Championship. So there's a reminder of the fact that there is money already being put in to run the leagues. And then there'll be a line on the commercial impact. And of course, I acknowledge that at the moment, women's football doesn't generate as much money as men's football. The challenge is, though, that the FA Cup prize money is kind of given by the FA. It's designated by the FA, and it is our governing body. And I feel like not that many people know the ins and outs of how that money is issued anyway. So something that people will say to me is, oh, but if you halved the men's FA Cup money, you know, the grassroots clubs would suffer, men's football would suffer. And I don't want any men's club to suffer, by the way. But in 2018, the men's FA Cup prize money was half. So in 2018, they doubled the men's prize pot, but didn't double the women's pot, hardly gave anything extra to the women's pot. So can you imagine that, you know, back in 2018, to win the FA Cup, men got 1.8 million. They now get 3.6 million in that for the FA Cup final. The women's team get £25,000 instead of 3.6 million. So last season, when Man City men and women both won the FA Cup, you know, the men won 3.6 million. Do they need that? Does Man City men need the 3.6 million? And then the women got £25,000. If we just evened that kind of money up, we would see a knock-on effect, because we'd see more men's clubs actually investing in their women's setup. Because if there was a, can you imagine, like, the incentives change a little bit, you know, especially for medium-sized clubs. Take a club like Barnet. Their women are in our division as well, in the Championship. Maybe they would get a bump of investment because actually they're more likely to do well in the FA Cup than their men's side is. And so then suddenly you see the Barnet, that, you know, the, called the Bees. You'd see the Bees suddenly increase their own investment. So I think there's knock-on effects there that I think are really crucial. And the last thing I want to say on that as well, around this commercial argument, if you don't invest, you're not going to get return on investment. There are multiple times that I have tried actively to spend money on women's football, and it's very, very difficult. Last year for the World Cup, I tried to buy a Scotland shirt, and it took me about 6 weeks to be able to track it down. I lived in London last year. I went to the local sports shops, and I live in London, not in Lewis at that time, you know, and there was no women's football shirts for sale in these London sports shops. So I went online. They had already sold out. I went to the England-Scotland game wearing a Scotland shirt that I'd bought like 10 years ago or something. You know, I'm trying to say that there are specific things that are frequently, we just don't let women's football make money. Talk to any player about trying to get female football boots or boots that fit them. You know, it's a constant challenge trying to spend money. So I think that the commercial argument really drives me crazy, because if we don't try to create those opportunities to generate funds, then of course we're going to make less money.
Yeah, it's definitely, it seems always that, and you know, it's funny you talk about that shirt thing, because my little sister had a similar challenge to you. She was trying to buy, and she was also here in London, right? She was also trying to buy a Scotland jersey to show her support and to get more involved. And the fact that she couldn't, again, you know, speaks volumes about that. But as soon as you try to buy the World Cup, the men's one, which happened just the year before, you couldn't get enough, right? The campaign almost went viral for the Nigeria shirt, right?
Yeah,
that
right.
Was like, you know, yeah. And it's to say, you're dealing here with women's football. A really good, easy way in for me would be fashion and celebrating the style that comes with football shirts, right? That is a globally known thing. And that is a good way in to market it even to women. But the fact that it isn't being done, they aren't in retail shops. You're not seeing those big collaborations the way you do, you know, for with the exception of Paris Saint-Germain, right? For both sides of the team to make this fashionable and a style item, right? That would then help generate that revenue that you're talking about to help stop these kind of what for me sound like really pathetic excuses, I'll be frank. Like, anyone wants to come and take me up on that, but you know, I do think that, because the barrier to actually creating a commercial proposition for women's football itself are inhibiting. So until, you know, everyone squares up, until, you know, the retailers, those brands out there that have really good share of voice, that to make space and way for women's football to make money, I do sympathize with you and say that actually it will be really, really tough to then go back to be able to make the arguments to your governing and funding bodies to give you a bigger share of that pot of money. But I do think there's maybe a confrontation that needs to happen with the men's side that are wealthier, and say, how can we help redistribute our wealth in the same way as, you know, your men's side has done with your club to help bolster up? And then hopefully over time, then those other external entities, you know, the likes of broadcasters who buy your broadcast rights deals, as well as, you know, the brands that kind of do your apparel, can start to say to themselves, okay, we've seen that the men's teams are putting X amount that we're giving them to their female team. So it's important, right? And I'm afraid that probably is the only way that it is going to change, when the men's team start to step up and give space and funding, putting their money where their mouth is, if you like, say to all the commercial partners they have that it is so important for us to make sure our women's team succeed like we are, that we are giving X of what you give us.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, you know, the difference that some of the clubs in the WSL have made in recent years is really, really important. You know, a lot of the WSL clubs now train in the same facilities, and they do campaigns online, which that they do more investment into the marketing side. And you know, obviously it must be working, because they continue to do it and it's continuing to grow. So there are clubs that are doing that. I guess you know, at the moment, I feel like sponsors are maybe missing a trick because even if the numbers of viewers for women's sport is smaller at the moment, I think the fans are really loyal. And so certainly for me, if I see a sponsor that is investing in women's sport, I am much more attuned to it and I acknowledge it and notice it. But I think that fans see it and are loyal. So even if what we lack in numbers, we maybe make up for in kind of some unwritten code, which is that, you know, we back those brands that back us. That's something that I think I'd like to be able to share with sponsors a little bit more, because they might not see that.
Yeah, no, I think definitely painting the picture about your brand loyalty and your customer loyalty and the sort of lifetime value of, you know, your fans, which are customers, is actually a very good thing to tell brands and to tell the story, particularly for sponsors, because if you can see that, yes, you start small, but you start from a very strong small, a small that's going to become essentially brand advocates that are going to convert more customers for you. Certainly me being a marketer, that seems like a really good place to invest my money in, because that customer base and that fan base is going to grow itself for me. So the amount of money I will then have to spend to recruit more customers and stuff will actually be a lot less straight off the bat than somewhere where I didn't have that level of advocacy and loyalty that you're just speaking to. So I think I would urge clubs in similar positions to you to tell those stories and give those numbers and be open to sharing that information with brands like ourselves to try and just, you know, and the marketers like ourselves, sorry, I should say, to make us much more educated about that. Because if I'm honest, until I started to interface and know about you and follow your journey in Lewis FC, I didn't really know those things. So I think it's also important to be vocal and be much more proud of the great work that you're doing and how you are helping to ignite communities and get them involved. Because for us, until we get to see those stories regularly and we get to see that data, it's easier for us to kind of turn a blind eye to now. But I think if we are much more confronted with it, it's a lot less able for us to shirk that off.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Good. I'm glad we agree. Yeah. But we, you know, once, and it's something that I really want to, you know, also kind of look ahead and see, concentrate on now, which is the big wins you have had, right? Because I think it's also important to tell those wins. And I want to focus on two dualities of wins here. I want to focus on ones you've had personally in your career that have been sort of career defining for you, that have got you to, you know, the success point you're at. Because I think one thing we should not, and I don't want anybody listening to this who's listened to us talk about the challenges, Maggie's also done some really incredible things that have moved things on, as well as also other people at Lewis FC and other clubs like women's teams. They are doing some really great work. If I look at Manchester City, for example, and how they've gone out and backed their women's side, that's also, you know, a really good news story. But what I want to do now is I want to spend time on looking at learnings you've had along the journey, right? As you are advocating for better equity and parity in the women's game, and say, what got you there? What kind of learnings did you get through? So if we could just spend some time now, this is what I'm calling the Maggie appreciation slot. Because I think I do want to have it, and I'm not going to be ashamed of that. I do want to have it, because I think it's important to make people understand that even if you work in an area like yours where you are faced with challenges, there actually are lots of good markers of progress and how they then help you build on for others, right? So if we could just take some time now, and you can do it in whatever order you want, of what your wins, losses, and draws, I kind of call this section, and what they've taught you and how you're using them to move you forward.
Okay, I'm ready. But I'll probably need prompting.
No, that's all right. Don't worry. I can talk. I can talk forever. I can talk for Scotland and England, as you know. Whilst both of us, that's something we actually share in common, right? That we have both a Scottish and a sort of English sort of upbringing, but Scottish, made in Scotland. Exactly. Yeah. So what I wanted to do was just to ask you, is there a kind of career defining project that you've had where you feel it taught you a lot of the resilience and the kind of a lot of the skill set you've got at Lewis to be able to kind of cut through these barriers we've talked about today?
Yeah, definitely. One springs to mind, but actually, if you ask me this tomorrow or next week or even at 4 p.m. today, I might have different ones. But I do have certain things that I do reflect back on and think, okay, that was good, bad, or ugly, but I have reflected on it. So one one thing that stands out for me was actually many years ago, more than 10 years ago, I was working for a very small human rights organization in the Netherlands. And I had been an intern and then got a job there and very quickly was seemed to be running a lot of things because we were so strapped for cash, so no resources. And I was super proud of one particular thing that I put a lot of energy and emotional energy into it as well. And even though we were a really, really small organization, I managed to build a coalition of other human rights organizations in the Netherlands, including Amnesty International and Greenpeace, I think. So big, big names, but we were the small group. And we wanted to mark the anniversary of the assassination of a Nigerian human rights activist called Ken Sarawiwa. I think it was 15 years since his assassination. And so we were the small entity in this, but we managed to pull off this huge event, which is not very normal for me. Like, this is definitely not the kind of thing I do or did, but we pulled off a big concert in The Hague in the Netherlands, and I was the main coordinator of that. The event went really, really well, and we had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people from around the Netherlands that came along to learn about what had happened. And we had an incredible singer that you should go and check out called Necker singing that we'd managed to persuade to come in and do this for free, and all these things. Like, I cannot express enough that this is not what I do. I don't put on concerts, but I felt so strongly about the issue and the and what we were trying to do. And it was me working with interns who put in, you know, hours and hours, blood, sweat, tears. This isn't the defining moment. That that night after the event, I went out with the band and with the, you know, the interns, and we'd been working really hard, and, you know, it was a celebration and it was months of effort, and we were just really excited. The next morning, I bought them all breakfast, and I said, don't come into work until, I think it was like, it wasn't late or anything, but it was 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. I bought them all breakfast. And then we went back into the office where my boss was. And my boss looked at me and said, as we walked in, there's about five or six of us, he just looked at me and said, you're late. And I said, yeah, I took the interns out, you know, they deserve it. You know, last night was a huge success. And he said, let's talk about why it went so badly. And the thing that got me about this, and I can feel myself getting angry already, Lizelle,
wow,
was that he came to the event. This is my boss. He came to the event and he left about 2 minutes before I was about 25, 26 at the time, made the opening speech to this packed room, hundreds of people, like the biggest event that this, my tiny organization, had ever held, right? And it was an incredible success. Like, people still talk about it. Later on, I got a job with Amnesty International, which I think was partly on the fact that they recognized the incredible work that I'd done to pull this event off. And the disregard that my boss had for me, but also the interns who had slogged their guts out for this project and for the impact that we had. And it almost came across as jealousy or something like that. But for me, that was a career-defining moment. I will never disrespect staff or colleagues or teammates in the way that that happened. It, for me, you don't have to have any money in order to pay somebody respect. And for me, it's so important now to be surrounded by good people and to be aligned and to all have the same values and principles. And I still get angry about it, as you can tell.
Yeah, no, listening to you made me angry, because I was just trying to think there to say, what on earth did he think had gone so badly, given what you were trying to do? You know, you were commemorating the memory of somebody who, you know, in your industry was looked up to and hailed for his work, and that ultimately cost him his life. What could possibly be seen as a bad thing about that? You know, it's actually quite maddening to think about, you know, that the level of ego that goes into that. But I guess, as you say, the great lesson that you learned from that was to say how he made you feel and how he made everybody else feel when you walked in the office, having accomplished something so big, was that you vowed that you would never, ever treat people that way. You would always look to appreciate the level of work that people do. And I think the point you made there really was a very pertinent one that I've myself learned over the time, is to say people don't necessarily need to have more money in their paycheck every month to feel appreciated. Mm-hmm. It's about how you treat them and the recognition that you give them for the effort and the work that they do, particularly when they're going above and beyond their job role, right? You pointed out there, and I, for the record, for anyone listening who doesn't know Maggie, I bet you this event was bloody brilliant because everything she does is. But you know, you did such a great job with that, and it wasn't your day-to-day job, but you put yourself into it because of how much you believed in the cause. And to think that that wasn't enough for basic recognition, it's tough, right? And I think, as you say, it's about going to find yourself someone you work for who you believe in because of how they treat you and how they appreciate you as a human being and the effort you put in, rather than just thinking, oh, we pay you, so you should just turn up.
Yeah, I mean, that day, in some ways it was helpful because he sped up my decision to quit. And from that day, I decided I would quit. And I went out and found another job much sooner than I expected that I was going to find one, and left very soon after. Because I think that whilst I don't hold grudges, and I still look back at my time in that organization as extremely formational, because of all the incredible work we did with these, it was working with the minority rights organization, and you know, the people that I worked with and on behalf of, I still hold all of that very, very dear to my heart. But it was for me a lesson in how not to manage, and it felt hypocritical, and hypocrisy is something that I really struggle with. That kind of situation has happened to me once since then, and immediately I've took the decision to leave as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's a brave decision that scares a lot of people, right? Because you sit there and you're like, oh, my livelihood, what will I do? Will I manage to get another job I love as much or that provides for me? But as you say, it's having that conviction in yourself to back your talent and your experience to say you can go and find somewhere that gives you that. And I just wanted to touch on to ask, you know, what is it that gives you that level of conviction in yourself? Do you have like a role model you've looked up to in your life that has given you that ability when you face these, you know, extreme challenges in a work setting that helps you to think, actually, no, I know I deserve better, and I'm going to walk and find better? Has there been an influence in your life that has given you that?
I think it's, I have a really strong sense of justice in a way, and fairness.
As all Scottish people do, as all I can attest to this, having grown up in Scotland.
And so both my parents are Scottish, from very large, big Catholic families. And so growing up, it was everything was around care and honesty and integrity and fairness and this kind of sense of justice. And so I do think that I grew up with these strong principles and values, but I also acted on them from quite a young age. I will always remember, I find it a little bit funny that when growing up, my dad and a family friend was they ran a youth club in the town, and I asked, you know, my two older brothers were going to the youth club, and they would get up to all these cool things, whether it was like archery one week, then fencing, then like abseiling. And I wanted a piece of it. I was about 10 or 11 years old, and I asked them, when can I join? And the answer I would get from the family friend was, oh, not yet. You're not old enough yet. And I was like, but when can I join? When? Like, when is this, like, you know, give me something to aim for here? Because it had never been written down in stone, right? So my dad just said to me, why don't you write a letter? So I think I was about 10 or 11 and wrote a letter saying, you know, when will I be allowed to join? I was given a response, okay, when you're 12 years old. So I was like, okay, fine, that's great, great. Now I understand what the parameters are. Now I understand. And if I'm not allowed in there on the first day of my 12th birthday, then I will be really frustrated. But I think for me, I'm always looking for the clarity and the criteria and the justice, and what am I working to here? And if I don't like the rules, then I'll try to maybe suggest some improvements to those rules. But at least give me some rules. I don't want this vagueness of
the ambiguity, you know, existing in ambiguity doesn't help anybody. And I love that, you know, your dad made you feel empowered to do that. Right? And I think that's probably, you know, I can see that from getting to know you and speaking to you in the last sort of few months, I can see that probably that is probably what's giving you that self-conviction, right, that you've needed, your parents empowering you from a very young age to be able to stand up for yourself and seek that clarity.
Oh, totally. I mean, my parents are fantastic. You know, I'm very lucky and very privileged to have grown up in such an incredible family. And I've got four brothers and sisters as well, and we all keep each other in check too. So I think there's a sense of justice that is dished out amongst brothers and sisters as well.
Yeah, especially in a big family. I recognize that. I recognize that a lot. Yeah.
And I think on top of that, with a big family like that, you know, I wasn't being mollycoddled in any way. And because I had two older brothers, if I wanted to go out and play in the garden, play football with them, someone was going to have to like seriously stop me somehow, because I would bring back this sense of justice and fairness. Well, if they're playing in the garden, then like, what's to stop me from playing in the garden? So I think, yeah, I've always had that, and they've always backed me. And even if they didn't, so my dad, for example, has always encouraged me to do what I want to do. I think my mum would have liked me to have done ballet. She took me to a ballet class, but I didn't even get into the class because I refused to go in when I could hear the shouting of like the 1, 2, 3, 4
too good.
In the other room from the teacher. And I was like, I'm not going in there. Like, too good. That is not for me. So I think my mum tried to test the waters.
Mama Murphy, you are bringing back some serious trauma for her. She's listening to this. Serious trauma, Maggie.
This is definitely not the aspired career. But no, I mean, I joke, but they've been so supportive and always backed me and never put a barrier in my way. And I just think that that's so important. Like, you know, I think the parents are real gatekeepers when it comes to you know, their children as to what they can and cannot do. And I think that if you have I don't think it's a coincidence that of all the incredible women that I've worked with in football, and we might come on to the equal playing field stuff that I've done as well, like those women from around the world, something that they had in common were parents, often fathers, who are gatekeepers, who opened the gate and said, yeah, you go for it, yeah, I'll back you. And I think that we often celebrate, you know, the role that dads have with their daughters and getting them to take part in sport, and it's so incredibly important and powerful, but partly because there's also lots and lots of dads who close the gate and are a gatekeeper and don't open that door. But I've always had an open gate, let's say.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I actually do want you to focus actually on your work at Eco Playing Fields, because I think this is probably what first sort of lit the fuel, right? And the trail for you to be able to come in and do a job like you're doing now at Lewis FC. Do you want to tell us about a project there that was kind of that allowed you to see the really pivotal role that actually men can play in helping women have better access to playing sport? Because I think some of the projects and the work you did there was really integral to change that in societies where that wasn't, you know, as natural a step to take. So if you could talk us through some of the successes you had there, I think that would also help to give people an idea. Particularly men who are also been listening to this podcast. I've been happy to say I have had lots of men listening to it and saying how inspired they have been by the story. So how can those men take lessons, you know, from a project like you did there and apply it into their own world to, you know, be that gate opener that you were talking about?
Yeah, this is a no-brainer for me. I mean, becoming part of the Equal Playing Field team and taking this decision back in 2016, 2017, to try to do something phenomenal that would make people sit up and take notice, has been really formational for me, I guess. So back in 2016, I became connected with a bunch of women around the world that each thought similarly, that, you know, we'd face these individual struggles. None of us were particularly working in football, let's say, but we'd each face these barriers when it came to opportunity, equality, and respect. And yeah, we came together, a small kind of coordinating group of a small handful of us, but working with women from more than 20 countries around the world. And that includes both elite players. So we had national team players from France and from Canada and the USA and England as well as grassroots players from a whole bunch of countries around the world. So we had players there from Nepal and from Saudi Arabia, from Mexico, Tanzania. And we all came together to try to set the Guinness World Record for the highest altitude football match ever played. I mean, it's out there now. So there's a little documentary that Be In Sports made about us. It's still online for free, actually. And yeah, so we climbed to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro. And once we were at the top, we set up a full-size football pitch and played a full 90-minute football match in the like choking for breath. Like, it was a really ugly match, let me put it that way. But I think that whole effort, it was an all-female football match. Our referees had to be FIFA accredited, and they were all women. But there was a big group of guys that helped us to get there and had supported us, and were part of the crew to get up the mountain, who believed in the project and believed in what we were trying to do. But also, behind every single one of us as individuals, we had supportive men and women behind us. Certainly some of the women that I remember climbing with us talking about how instrumental their dads had been, their parents had been in opening up their journey through football, because for every single one of us, there were at least 5, 6, 7, 10, 20 other women and girls who had stopped playing football because, or had never started because, they just didn't have that same supportive framework around them. So yeah, the Guinness World Record was incredible. We thought that was it at the time. We thought, you know, hey, we've done this cool thing and we've got this documentary going out. But actually, it was only the very start, because we made such incredible connections and networks, and we're still in contact all the time with each other. And we set another Guinness World Record the following year for the lowest altitude football match by the Dead Sea in Jordan, which was just hot and clammy and exhausting. And then during the Women's World Cup last year, we set another two Guinness World Records, one for the biggest game ever. So we had more than 800 players play the same five-a-side game of football, so subbing on and off. We also played the largest number of nationalities in a single game, because we suddenly realized that we had all these 800 players around, so why don't we do that, try and smash two Guinness World Records at the same time. And it's not just about the Guinness World Record. Obviously, when we were together, we were running workshops and connecting people, and doing training sessions, and we ran a training session for referees, and we were trying to run sessions to inspire women and girls to get into different parts of football as an industry, just trying to support them on their own personal journeys as well. So yeah, Equal Playing Field is doing some incredible things. We're all volunteers, you know. I do that in evenings and weekends and lunch breaks sometimes, it's tough and it's difficult. And I think the Guinness World Record is not really just about the 90 minutes at the top of Kilimanjaro. Yeah. It was for the months and months and months of really hard work going into it.
That went before, yeah. And the level of commitment, right, that took it. And I think, you know, when people are working in sport, you know, how can they get involved with Eco Playing Field? Because I think hearing about the project you did there and the levels of, you know, kind of cultural attitudes it had an impact on, to open up access to women playing and also sharing their experiences, right, which helped to strengthen and then get them... How can people, first of all, watch the documentary from BeIn? Because I think it'll be good for them to see that. And then how can they then get involved in Eco Playing Fields to help continue to support that great work that you're doing there and the learnings that you took?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things, really. One is, the documentary, if you just Google BeIn Sports Equal Playing Field documentary, it should come up. And it's just 1 hour. And I think I've heard of lots of people that have watched it with their kids as well, and they found it fun and inspirational. I think that if you go to the Equal Playing Field YouTube channel, we have so many beautifully shot videos that are lovely just to watch, but also could be used as an educational tool. So we focus in on particular players from different countries. So we've got Yasmin from Jordan, who is really eloquent and has gone on to so much from that Equal Playing Field, the first Guinness World Record. She's now an ambassador in her country for all kinds of trying to get more girls to play football. And, you know, her story is on there, as well as some of the work from our partners in like Costa Rica or from Cambodia as well. So we've got beautifully shot videos. And to get involved, I mean, we're active on social media, and we're always playing with new ideas, so there will be more things coming up. So I think the first thing is to stay in touch, especially on the Facebook page or on Instagram or Twitter, and just keep an eye on us. We've got a newsletter and things like that, and we'll be sending out details for new challenges for people to get involved. And to be blunt, any donation is always helpful. Because we're always trying to be able to do more so that we can support our partners around the world, especially during COVID time. We're still working with our you know, we're still collaborating with our partners in all these different countries trying to keep girls in sport.
Yeah, no, and it's more important than ever. So yeah, no, definitely. So it's equal playing fields. And when I post out this episode, we will make sure that we have sure. links and things like that to that work too, because I think it's so important for us as a sports industry to really lean in and help prop up organizations like that. And knowing that we can get involved alongside our day-to-day jobs as well is also, I think, and you know, another really great thing that can add to people's enjoyment of giving back. Yeah. So yeah, so just so you know, I am desperate, Maggie. I'm going to keep pushing you on this. I want to get an experience that you are really also really proud of at Lewis, right? Something mm-hmm. that you've done there, that you've come along, that you know it was maybe a build from other work you did there, like at sport at Equal Playing Fields, or back in your days, you know, when you're working at organizations like Amnesty International. Mm-hmm. Has there been something where you've thought, I'm so glad I took this opportunity because of it's given me X when I'm here and it's helped me to get this really great tangible bit of progress or win for my women's team?
Well, okay, so it's difficult. I mean, I've been here for just a year, so it's my first season, and obviously the season was curtailed because of COVID. So much as I would have loved to have won the league, you know, it didn't quite happen. No, I think
it'll happen the next season. It'll happen exactly next season. Right, exactly. I'm backing you. I'm going to put a bet on it, right?
Yeah, no, I think for me, there's a couple of things really. There's I think that this season has been really good to understand where we are as a club and to really fine-tune our ambition and get some plans in place. So it sounds really boring, but I've worked really, really hard with the directors here to build a really tangible strategy for taking it forward, because I think previously, you know, you're just so stretched, you just try and deal with the day-to-day. One thing that it's a bit difficult for me to say, and it feels a bit strange, but I think that my players are happy here, and that means a lot to me. They say that they are happy. They've said that they are happier now at the club than they had been before, and they believe that the team that we have here, I've heard some of the players say it's the best team they've ever played for and with. And that doesn't happen by accident. That happens through constantly trying to create an environment around them. So it might feel like it's by accident that they have this really coherent team, but behind the scenes, we work tirelessly to make sure that's actually in place. And myself, and especially my colleague Lynn, the assistant general manager, the two of us are working really hard in the back office to try to create that environment. I think that once we have that kind of team spirit, which is really strong, in place, I think that is when we can take it to the next level on the pitch as well. And I'm really excited about next season. I think it's going to be a good season. But I think those are small things. I think it's too soon for me to point at specific things. I'm trying to work really hard with our pathway teams as well. We've just recruited a brand new set of coaches for some of those roles, and I'm really excited to see the impact that will have. So there's loads and loads of stuff behind the scenes that no one really notices if they just look at our results on a Sunday. But I think we're in a good place. I think we've got some really exciting things in place. And sometimes it's the most boring things that have to go first. It is the policies, procedures, the strategy, the targets, the goals, the processes. You know, once we've got those in place, then it frees you up to do even more that might get recognized externally. But for now, I'm just really happy that the players are happy. We had to say goodbye to a few players just in the last couple of weeks, and it was really, really difficult because they didn't want to go. And I'm trying to take that as like, at least we're doing something right. We're on the right path. So
I think you can take it as more than you're doing something right. I think you know, it's certainly myself hearing reports and you know, as I'm starting to get more and more into the world of women's football, when I do hear any players' experiences of your club, it is really positive, and in particular the excitement around you becoming general manager. So I think you should be proud of yourself because you've achieved a great lot there. So just as we're looking ahead to next season and generally your career in the next sort of, let's look 10 years time from now, what would you like your legacy to be? What would you like that one thing that Maggie Murphy's remembered for to be?
Oh, I think this is a tricky one. I mean, ultimately, I want it to be really normal for any girl to go to the park and play football. That doesn't sound very ambitious, but it's the most ambitious of all. It's more ambitious than winning the World Cup, You know, it's the idea that, I mean, how infrequent is it for you to go to the park and see a girl kicking a ball with a bunch of other girls? You'll sometimes see a girl kicking a ball with her family, and you might see a girl amongst other boys as like that unique, strong individual with thick skin that's happy to play with the boys. But you rarely see a bunch of girls kick a ball in the park together. And you rarely see girls who are not very good at football kicking a ball in the park. And yet you see lots of boys all the time who are a bit rubbish playing football just because it's a game and because they're having fun and because they socialize with their mates and that's just what they do. And I would really like there to be lots of not very good girls playing football in the park just like them in 10 years' time.
No, I think you say it's not very ambitious, but I actually think to your point, it is very, very ambitious. And I think this is something that sport, we need to all square up to, everybody working in the industry, to be much more ambitious about the role we can play in helping to move gender parity forward, whether that's at a participation level or whether that is at an elite professional level. So, you know, certainly for me, I think I will always remember you as somebody who helped to make me more active about wanting to do something to square that up, you know, that real unequal playing field, to get it to a much better place. So, you know, I thank you, Maggie, for your time, most of all, getting involved in this project and telling your story, which I think will inspire and resonate with so many people who want to make different changes and strides. And what I love the most is that you found a way to marry up your sense of wanting to create a better place and a better world and better access for women to playing sport with your love for football. So, you know, keep going. I'll be cheering Lewis FC on next season and all every other season to come. And hopefully soon I'll be able to come down to a game. And I think everyone, I would encourage who listens to this to go down and support Maggie and the team, because what they're doing there is truly, and I know you don't want me to say this, it is truly revolutionary. And I think you should be recognized for that yourself and the rest of the team at Lewis FC, because hopefully that becomes the blueprint of how football goes forward.
Thanks so much, Lizelle. It's been lovely speaking to you. And all I can say really is that we're only at the start, and I can't wait to achieve more with Lewis on this issue. So, watch the space, I guess.
Amazing. We definitely will. Thank you very much for everyone for listening. This is In Her Corner. You've been with your host, Lizelle Sitali, and the wonderful Maggie Murphy from Lewis FC.